Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Enrollment in health insurance plans is ratcheting up now as we gear up for full implementation of the health care reform law known as Obamacare in 2014. With more people insured than ever before, the demand for health services is likely to grow commensurately. At the center of the deluge is the primary care physician, the type of doctor we used to refer to as a GP who coordinates your care and keeps track of the big picture of your overall health, while sometimes needing to refer you to specialists for select conditions. Pundits and health economists have long touted primary care as essential to a high-functioning, efficient healthcare system. The national systems with the best outcomes in the world have roughly a 50-50 split of primary to specialty care, but in the U.S. we are skewed towards specialty care as generations of doctor trainees have made the choice to enter subspecialty fields with their narrower scope and higher pay. The most recent data suggests that only 2% of current U.S. medical school graduates plan to enter the field of my guest today, Dr. Suzanne Coven of the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Coven is both a general internist, the type of doctor who does primary care for adults, and also a writer. She pens the In Practice column for the Boston Globe. She's just written an outstanding essay, her first, for The New Yorker, asking the question, should mental health be a primary care doctor's job? It appeared on the NewYorker.com website October 21st. She's my guest today at Studio Tulsa on Health. Dr. Suzanne Coven, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thanks for having me.
I really like this article, and I wonder if you'd start by just reading the first two paragraphs.
Sure, I'd be glad to. People occasionally ask me if I'll be the doctor who'll take out a gallbladder or deliver a baby. I tell them, you deserve better. I'm a primary care internist, and my expertise is broader than it is deep. I manage high blood pressure and cholesterol, but refer people with heart attacks to cardiologists. I perform PAP tests and prescribe birth control pills, but send pregnant women to obstetricians. And I often diagnose, but never treat, cancer. With mental illness, though, the limits of my role are less clear. I'm comfortable helping people get through life's more common emotional challenges, like divorce, retirement, disappointing children. If you're hearing voices, or if you walk into my office and announce that you've decided to kill yourself, as someone did not long ago, I know exactly what to do. Escort you to a psychiatrist. But what about the lawyer who's having trouble meeting deadlines and wants medication for attention deficit disorder? Or the businesswoman whose therapist told her to see me about starting an antidepressant? Or the civil servant trying to shake his OxyContin addiction? They've all asked me to treat them because they don't want or can't easily access psychiatric care.
Thank you. That's such a great lead and just raises so many questions and just frames the issues so beautifully. Mm-hmm. You know, you go on in the article talking about the challenges. First of all, tell us about just the numbers that you explore in the article. I mean, how hard is it to find mental health care, you know, where you are in Massachusetts or nationally?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very sort of complicated and multifaceted problem because the question of how hard it is not only about numbers. Now, for people who need child psychiatric services, you know, for children, the numbers are important because there just aren't enough child psychiatrists. And it turns out in rural states, particularly in the rural West, there aren't enough psychiatrists. But even where I'm practicing in Boston, which you know, in theory has plenty of psychiatrists, there are still a lot of barriers to people accessing care. You know, there are barriers around their insurance coverage, which may be more limited for mental health and for other kinds of medical services. And then another thing that I talked about in the article is that a lot of my patients just don't want to see a psychiatrist for a variety of reasons. You know, I have a long-time relationship with them as their primary care doctor, and they feel that if they have, you know, a psychological problem, I should be able to handle it as a first line. Sometimes that's true. But there's an awful lot of time when I feel like I'm practicing psychiatry without a license, so to speak. And I think many other primary care docs feel the same way.
So how have you fortified yourself? I mean, you allude in the article to the fact that your practice group met, you know, several years ago, I guess, and decided, you know, this is out of our comfort zone. But the realization became that the demand for mental health services is so great that, you know, it's not even a question anymore of if you'll do it. It's simply how to do it most effectively, right?
Yes, I think that's very true. And I'm not sure that's such a bad thing. You know, it's such a complicated issue, this issue of demand. You know, one issue is whether there are a lot of just, you know, the ups and downs of life that we have medicalized and that people are seeking, you know, medical treatment for things that really aren't medical issues. So that's one aspect of demand. But on the other hand, and, you know, I think I quote some rather startling statistics in this piece about the percentage of Americans who are taking psychiatric drugs, which is, you know, something like 20%. So, you know, it just would not be realistic to think that all of these people are going to be sent to psychiatrists. But on the other hand, you know, part of the subtext of this whole discussion is the attitude that, well, you know, psychiatric problems, they're not really like medical problems, and anybody who's a nice doctor who has good common sense could probably, you know, just deal with it. Well, you know, nobody is saying that about taking out people's gallbladders. You know, if you were just a nice doctor, it didn't matter if you had enough training, you could just take out somebody's gallbladder. If I tried to do that, I would kill somebody. I don't think psychiatric illness is exactly like that. But I do think that we in primary care are overreaching. However, the reality is that there aren't enough psychiatrists and never will be for us to send everybody with a psychiatric issue to a psychiatrist, which is why I was quite interested in these new models of telemedicine that I talk about in the piece.
Yeah, so you introduced a term that was new to me, telemental health. Can you describe that for us?
Yeah. So this is apparently, it was relatively new to me, too, because I've not experienced it myself. But, you know, people know about telemedicine, and the kind of classic version of that, which makes intuitive sense, is that, you know, say you're a family doctor without easy access to, say, a radiologist or a dermatologist. And, you know, one can easily picture transmitting an image of an X-ray or a rash and getting an opinion about it. That makes perfect sense. Well, in telemental health, it's the same principle, but you may actually have a patient assessed via something that, you know, like Skype, by a psychiatrist who is not on site. Now, intuitively, you might, as I did, kind of recoil from that idea. There's something sort of very creepy and futuristic, almost Big Brotherish about it. But in fact, if you look at the data, which I did, there's linked in the New Yorker piece a very nice recent paper looking at data from lots of sites. This telemental health actually works pretty well if you look at things like psychiatric hospitalization prevention and medication compliance and so forth. It actually works pretty well. And this is found really fascinating. In cases of child psychiatry and adolescent psychiatry, there were some studies showing that telemental health actually worked even better than on-site, you know, face-to-face interaction with a psychiatrist. So I'm kind of an old-fashioned, you know, doctor with a kind of romantic image of the doctor-patient relationship and so forth, and tend to be rather resistant to these kind of advances. But, you know, I think we have to look at the data and also the reality of supply and demand and understand that this is what the future is going to look like. And, in fact, it may not be such a bad thing.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Dr. Suzanne Coven of the Massachusetts General Hospital. She's also a writer. She writes the In Practice column for the Boston Globe and just had an article come out on the New Yorker website October 21st titled, Should Mental Health Be a Primary Care Doctor's Job? And in it, she cites some interesting new models, including using telemental health or telemedicine, that is a virtual visit through a mechanism like Skype to bring in mental health or psychiatric help. And one of the studies that you cited kind of had the surprising finding about children and adolescents that it often works better than face-to-face care. And I guess we're left to wonder why that might be. Is that because mm-hmm. we think kids are so attached or used to video screens, perhaps, that it's more comfortable to have literally a doc in a box or doc on a screen than it is to maybe talk to someone uh-huh. in the flesh?
Yeah. Now, I don't know the answer, but that thought occurred to me. The other thought that occurred to me, though, as a mom myself, is, every parent will tell you that sometimes the best conversations they have with their kids are in the car, where you're not actually making eye contact, and particularly that's the time when a teenager is most likely to open up. And I wonder if there's a little bit of that phenomenon going on as well, predates the computer era.
Yeah, that's true. The car ride does, and yes, I've experienced that myself. It's you're right about that. I like your theory better than the one about mm-hmm. the screens.
I know, the one about the screens is a little depressing.
Yeah. So clearly, you mentioned you've been in practice, or you consider yourself an old-fashioned doctor. So you have been doing this for some time. And so I guess I wonder, how long has this idea, at least for this article, been germinating? That is, how long has it been, clearly some time, that you've been, essentially functioning as an overall provider for your patients and doing this mental health? Clearly, there was some inflection point where you went from saying, well, this is really the psychiatrist realm, to this is something I'm going to have to do. I guess at what point did you think about, writing about it?
Well, I think one answer to that question is that in some ways I've been thinking about it for over 20 years, which is as long as I've been in practice. You know, people, particularly my readers at the Boston Globe, will sometimes ask me, how do you think of a new idea to write about every month? And I also blog for the Globe's website every week, so it's a lot of material. And I always say, I think about something that either personally or clinically makes me feel uncomfortable, and then I write about that, and I find that always to be a very fruitful starting off point. If there's something I feel quite sure about, and this isn't just for medical writing, any writer will tell you this, if there's something you feel quite sure about, and you know everything there is to know about it, and you don't really have any questions about it, it's probably going to be a pretty boring piece of writing, because the best writing, just has this sense of play and exploration. So what I've tried to do in the last few years that I've been writing, professionally especially, is I sort of try to pay attention to my discomfort. And I think when I started thinking about this particular piece was when I saw this business who came in because she was seeing a therapist who I believe was a social worker and was unable to prescribe medication, but who felt that she needed medication. And she didn't want to see a psychiatrist. She wanted me to prescribe the medication. And as I say, quite frankly, in the New Yorker piece, I actually was sitting there mentally crossing my fingers that the first thing I prescribed would work and that wouldn't have any side effects. Because I knew that the limitation of my abilities as an untrained psychiatrist or such, that if I needed to go the next step or the next, step after that perhaps, I was going to run out of ideas and that then I would need to find her a psychiatrist. And I thought, that's pretty messed up. I can't think of any other, and I'm in a medical academic mecca in Boston, the medical capital of the world, really, just about, with almost infinite access or certainly greater access to specialty care than any place on the planet. And I'm sitting there mentally crossing my fingers that I won't need a specialist. That's kind of messed up. And, there's really no other kind of medical problem I deal with where I'd be sitting there doing that. In other words, for example, if I saw someone with a rash and I couldn't quite figure out what the rash was, I wouldn't sort of wing it. And yet, in this situation, because of the nature of psychiatry and the position of mental illness in our culture, which is a whole other question, and you know, trying to accommodate to what the patient's wishes were, and her insurance, and on and on and on. I was in this odd position, and I just it just was something that stuck in my craw, and I wanted to learn more about it, and so I wrote about it.
Why do you think your patient was so comfortable? I mean, actually, the example you gave, the patient had a therapist who, mm-hmm. it sounds like, couldn't really prescribe because was a non-physician mm-hmm. practitioner. But
right.
But in other examples you give, you mentioned how some patients don't want to meet another professional. They'd rather, you know, have you, who knows them the best or the longest, help with their problems as they run the gamut. So
right.
you know, is it the stigma that we still harbor for, you know, issues with mental illness, or is it the convenience factor, a little bit of both?
I think it's a little bit of both. What I've noticed during the time I've been practicing is that I think the stigma is less and the reluctance to see a psychiatrist is less, particularly among men, particularly among older men. You know, when I first went into practice, say, 23 years ago, to suggest to, say, a 60-year-old man that he might need to see a psychiatrist was generally, you know, a non-starter. And now it's not unusual for a 60-year-old man to ask me for a referral to a psychiatrist. So, you know, I don't have that many data points. I'm only one doctor, but I would guess my colleagues would agree there's been a certain shift in that regard. And there's been a lot, you know, more celebrities, public figures, and so forth who have come out and talked about depression and bipolar disorder and anxiety disorder and so forth. I think what it has to do with more, though, is more subtle, which is what I was alluding to before, which is the idea that psychiatry, unlike, say, surgery or obstetrics, is something that anybody could do. That, you know, they look at me and I know them pretty well, and I'm pretty empathic, and, you know, I communicate pretty well. And they think, well, so she could just be my psychiatrist. And, you know, it's not just me, but you know, I think a lot of people feel that way about their primary care doctors. I mean, hopefully most of us are pretty engaged and pretty empathic and interested in establishing long-term relationships, and that's why we went into primary care. But in fact, if you look at studies of primary care doctors' ability to diagnose and treat illnesses, disorders, conditions like anxiety and depression, we're not all that great at it. And we're not really that great at doing therapy. And big surprise, we've never been trained to do either of those things. Not only that, there's the time factor. You know, some of your older listeners may remember a famous book from years ago called The 50-Minute Hour, which was about psychiatry. Well, if primary care doctors are functioning as psychiatrists, you're talking about the 10-minute hour. And it's, you know, 10 or 15 minutes in which not only are we assessing response to a psychiatric medication, we're also, you know, I don't have to tell you, this is what you do too as a primary care doc. We're also, you know, managing diabetes and hypertension and, you know, and a million other things. So we don't have the training. We don't have the time. And yet, you know, our patients look at us and we think, well, you know, you could do this. And I understand that they feel that way. But I also understand that, you know, as I say in the piece, just as I would say to somebody who wanted me to deliver their baby, you know, you could do better, and you deserve better.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guest is Dr. Suzanne Coven of the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and she's just written her very first piece for The New Yorker entitled, Should Mental Health Be a Primary Care Doctor's Job? And in the article, you also elaborate a little bit, and we've touched on it, about the concept of parity. And I wonder if you would share with us what is meant by parity and if you think we've achieved anything close to that.
Well, you know, parity, you know, in the medical world, it means other things. I think it's a term commonly used in professional sports as well. but don't quiz me about what that means there. But in the medical world, what parity usually refers to is insurance coverage for mental health services that is equal to insurance coverage for other kinds of medical services. So, for example, it's not unusual. In fact, most people probably have insurance that will cover your appendectomy and will cover your blood pressure treatment and so forth. And yet, if you need to see a therapist or if you need addiction services and so forth, you don't have any coverage. And that's a terribly discriminatory thing. If you think about it, it's really quite astounding, given how common addiction issues are and psychiatric issues are. And yet, oftentimes we don't question it. In recent years, it's been more questioned, and there's been more pressure brought to bear to try to bring coverage into line, including a provision in the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, you know, attempting to improve coverage for addiction and other mental health services.
Do you think we'll get there?
I think it will require a kind of cultural shift. This is really a cultural issue as much as sort of an issue of health economics. I personally, when my family was choosing our health coverage, and I looked at what was included and what wasn't included, clearly it was a plan that did not, as most people plans didn't offer parity. I didn't think twice about it, and I'm in this field, so I think it's going to take patient advocacy groups and legislative efforts to bring it into line. Insurance companies, obviously, on their own, are not going to do this because, unlike certain other medical and surgical conditions, psychiatric issues, addiction issues take time. They can take months. They can take years. Visits are longer, and the business aspect of the system is not very accommodating to that.
I wonder, you don't really recommend in the piece a policy solution, but in terms of acknowledging the fact that primary care doctors are in fact already and are going to be front and center, especially as more people get insurance under the Affordable Care Act, people will be seeking varieties of mental health services, probably a lot from their primary care homes. We didn't talk about that, patient-centered medical homes. Are there policy recommendations you'd make as far as at least how to get primary care docs more attuned or more trained, since you acknowledge and I agree with the fact that we have very little training in behavioral health?
Well, as I thought about the conundrum, the question that I set up at the beginning, there's something wrong with this equation. We have not enough supply of psychiatrists, too much demand for psychiatric care, and too much provision of that care by people who don't have the time or training to provide it. So, which part of that problem do you wrestle with? I actually really like this model that's been promoted in several places, including the one I profile here at Harvard Medical School Center for Primary Care, where they're embedding mental health workers into primary care practices. I think that if there's a way to cover that, it's really, in a sense, the best of both worlds. I don't object to providing mental health care in a primary care practice, except at the extremes of severity where, people are needing hospitalization or really sort of critical levels of care. I really like dealing with the emotional problems of my patients and the psychiatric problems of my patients. That's, in fact, probably my favorite aspect of what I do. But I need more help, and I need more expert help. And the idea of having video access, phone access, in-person access to psychiatric social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists is very, very attractive to me. And I'd love to see, more team-centered care and, a coverage system that is rewarding that kind of care.
I want to just shift gears here toward the end of our time and ask you the following, which is that it seems as though we have a time now where there are many excellent physician writers like you that are out there, and I wonder how you became a writer or got your start or, you know, decided that you wanted to enter that realm.
Well, that's a great question. There certainly are a lot of physician writers, also nurse writers and therapist writers and so forth. I think those of us who go into any aspect of patient care tend to be very attracted to the hearing and telling of stories. That's basically how we function. It's what we do all day. We may call it morning rounds or writing a history or writing a progress note, but we're really telling stories, writing stories. I had been an English major in college and was always interested in writing. And then, I reached a point in my 40s, as many people do, when you think, I've been doing what I'm doing for a long time, and I wonder what new direction I can take it in or complement it with. And so I started writing, taking writing courses, as many doctor writers do, started writing about medicine and about my patients.
Well, Suzanne Coven, it's been wonderful to talk to you, and congratulations on your first article in The New Yorker. And you are also a longtime columnist for the Boston Globe, and you write the In Practice column.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Suzanne Coven is a writer and internist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. She writes the In Practice column for the Boston Globe and has just written her first piece for TheNewYorker.com. Well, that's our show for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed on Studio Tulsa are those of our guests and commentators and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our recent shows, you can find them online at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for the Studio Tulsa link under the Programs tab. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.